From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The Senate will convene at 4 p.m. Eastern time today to vote on the two articles of impeachment against President Trump. They are not expected to vote to remove him from office. And last night in his State of the Union, President Trump sounded like a man expecting to run again, urged on at the outset by Republican lawmakers chanting four more years in a speech that was more like a campaign rally. But fact checkers are in overdrive. So let's do a little now with NPR White House reporter Aisha Roscoe. Hi, Aisha.
Hello.
And the president, as you heard, talked up the economy. Understandably, it's very good. Let's listen.
America's fortunes are on the rise, and America's future is blazing bright. The years of economic decay are over.
Aisha, economic decay? I thought maybe he means the Obama administration, previous to his. So remind us again, what do economists say about when this strong economy we see now started?
Well, so the economy was growing and there was growth in jobs before President Trump came into office. And for instance, when you look at the 38 months since the 2016 election, the U.S. economy has added 7.3 million jobs. But in the same amount of time before Trump's election, the economy added 8.4 million jobs.
Yeah.
And the U.S. economy did grow at 2.3% last year, still, but that's lower than the 3% growth target that the Trump administration actually set for itself. So the economy is strong, but there's some nuance there, and it didn't all start with President Trump.
Yeah. Well, he also claimed that the manufacturing sector was making a comeback, that 60,000 factories were shuttered under both the Obama and Bush administrations, but he's added 12,000 factories. So what is true about manufacturing jobs?
So the U.S. has added 487,000 manufacturing jobs since Trump took office. There was a very strong growth in manufacturing in 2018. But last year, there was a slump. The U.S. only added about 29,000 factory jobs. And this is because largely because of the president's trade war with China. It disrupted supply chains and factories took a hit.
Yeah, because of those tariffs and maybe worldwide output. But also, according to the Labor Department, we're seeing manufacturers lost jobs last year in Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, where Trump had pledged those jobs would surge. So there's that. And then there's health care. Let's listen again to the president.
I've also made an ironclad pledge to American families. We will always protect patients with pre-existing conditions.
The White House is also, though, backing states in federal court, states that are arguing to abolish the Affordable Care Act, which makes that pledge to protect pre-existing conditions. You know, this would seem to be blatantly not true. Why does the president claim it is?
Well, at this point, the president is saying that they're going to protect pre-existing conditions because it's a very popular part of Obamacare. It's a very part of that law. But right now, as you said, the administration is supporting a lawsuit that would scrap the entire thing, that would scrap the Affordable Care Act. He says, and the president says, that they will make sure that even if that happens, they'll come up with a new plan. The problem is the administration has not come out with a health plan that would replace the Affordable Care Act if it is struck down. So we don't know how they would actually follow through on these claims that they would protect pre-existing conditions.
By the way, the president also said he's working with senators and he'll sign any bill to lower prescription costs that is put on his desk. And that's when there was that protest chant from House Democrats who have passed a bill to do just that, and it's stuck in the Senate. So they felt that that was a little bit hypocritical. But Aisha, we have to ask you about the tone in Washington today, because as many are pointing out, and we just did, the president said many things that were just not true. And Nancy Pelosi said after the speech that that's why, in response, she tore up his speech at the end. Quite a moment. What is Washington saying today about all of this? Is it just along party lines?
It's basically along party lines that you have a lot of Republicans who are raising concerns and saying that they felt like it was inappropriate that she took this action. Speaker Pelosi is defending her actions, and, you know, Democrats are defending what she did. This is a very partisan time in general. And the president has obviously doled out a lot of attacks and done a lot of things that as a president, that has not been common for presidents before, and especially in attacking his opponents. So this is just a very a time where there is just a lot of vitriol in D.C.
There certainly is. NPR White House reporter Aisha Roscoe, thank you.
Thank you.
The Iowa Democratic Party still has not released the full results of Monday's caucuses after technical difficulties with the mobile app brought the party's first presidential nominating contest of the year to a grinding halt. As we all wait for the results, there are new questions about the team behind the app called Shadow, as well as questions about one of Shadow's investors, the politically connected nonprofit Acronym. For more, we're joined now by Deepa Sitharaman. She's a reporter for The Wall Street Journal. And Deepa, what more can you tell us about what went wrong on Monday?
We have a few more details about the app and its relationship to a very well-connected Democratic nonprofit called Acronym. And our sense is that it was a pretty small team, really shoestring operation. And a lot of the people on the team had digital politics experience. You know, some of them worked on Hillary Clinton's campaign, and quite a few others didn't have that experience. One was an architectural designer for very recently before joining the firm. Another was a teacher. Our sense is also that this is a team that really raced to get it done. You know, the project started around November. They were paid again in December. They were working on this app through the month of January. And even in the weekend before the Iowa caucuses, they were pushing these final updates to try to get the app in as stable a position as possible.
So this company, which is called Shadow, do you know how they got the job in Iowa?
Our best understanding right now is that they were being promoted by Acronym and its founder, Tara McGowan, in a lot of different states. And so we know that some of the contracts that they got over the past year came from their connections to this company, which is very splashy, very prominent, and well-known organization in Democratic politics. As to what specifically drew the connection between Shadow and the Iowa Democratic Party, those details are still emerging. But we know right now that the connection to Acronym did them a lot of favors.
Okay, so perhaps that may be why we did not see the Democratic Party discover some of these problems before caucus night?
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is an organization that was moving really quickly, that was developing technology that was new for the party, and it was really under the radar. One of the unusual things about the way that this kind of controversy unfolded is the fact that prior to the caucuses, nobody knew who this company was. I mean, the Democratic Party wasn't telling anybody, wasn't telling the public, and it was instructing precinct captains not to share the name of the vendor, not to share the name of the company behind the app. They had said it was for security reasons, but a lot of cybersecurity experts say that's concerning, that you want to have that level of transparency, you know, before a big event, because you have to assume the hackers know the identity of the vendor.
More about that relationship. So according to the Federal Election Commission, Shadow also received payments from the presidential campaigns of former Vice President Joe Biden and former Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg. Buttigieg has several ties to Shadow. Have their campaigns said anything about those relationships?
Not yet. I mean, we know that, you know, the Shadow in particular had a lot of people from the Hillary Clinton campaign. Right now, we don't have a sense that this is anything but a technical failure. All our sources are indicating that this isn't a hack. This wasn't a breach of any kind. It was coding errors and sort of layers of technical issues on top of each other in a rush job.
Yeah. Part of the promise that Acronym apparently made to its Democratic clients was that they would help build a digital strategy to rival President Trump. So what does this whole debacle really say about the state of the Democratic Party and its digital operations as the elections get underway? What lessons could other state party officials take from Iowa?
you know, this feels like an unforced error. This isn't something that really needed to happen. And it raises questions about the overall preparedness of the Democratic Party. I mean, Donald Trump has a very sophisticated, aggressive, intentional digital campaign. We don't have a parallel operation right now in the Democratic Party. The messaging is still being fine-tuned. It's sort of all over the map. And then you have just not a cohesive strategy around how to deploy technology. I mean, this is a case where, you know, the Democratic Party in Iowa is trying to update the system. They initially said that this app would be a really simple, reliable, effective way to tally votes. And so it raises a lot of questions about how serious the Democrats are about really weaving in technology and new platforms into their campaign. And when it's a company like Acronym that's implicated in all of this, that sort of muddies the waters more because Acronym was trying to solve that imbalance. Mm-hmm. They had $75 million that they were going to deploy to digital efforts to defeat Donald Trump. And so it raises some questions about whether that's going to happen in this election cycle and how.
That's Deepa Seetharaman. She is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Deepa, thank you.
Thank you so much.
What's good, y'all? As you know, February is Black History Month. And all throughout that month, NPR's Code Switch is going to be running a special series about the history of Black resistance. Because as long as Black folks have been oppressed in this country, which is, you know, forever, we've also been fighting back. Listen and subscribe.
This week, we've been looking at science under the Trump administration, or as some researchers call it, the silencing of science. They're keeping a tracker with examples. We also heard this week about the USDA moving several offices to Kansas City, resulting in employees quitting what's being called a brain drain. Those stories are at herenow.org. Today, the status of science at the Environmental Protection Agency. You've probably already heard about how the EPA is scrapping protections for waterways, officials saying it's to correct federal overreach. But you may not have heard about how the EPA is also relaxing rules on asbestos, or how it prevented NASA from flying a plane over Houston after Hurricane Harvey to measure air quality, something the EPA disputes. If you haven't heard, you'd be forgiven. There's a lot of news coming out of Washington and a lot of rollbacks at the EPA, most occurring over the objections of the agency's own scientists, some of whom are even Trump appointees. For more, let's bring in Michael Halpern, Deputy Director of the Center for Science and Democracy at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Michael, welcome.
It's great to be with you, Robin.
And, you know, there's just so much. I mean, you feel as if every day when you know, those of us who still pick up newspapers, there it is on the front page, something being rolled back at the EPA. But just to start, we know that scientists have been sounding an alarm for decades. We remember 1988. You had James Hansen, the former NASA scientist. It was considered the first warning to a mass audience about global warming. He told the U.S. congressional hearing he could declare with 99% confidence that it was human-caused. He was scorned, you know, by the then administration. So this has been going on, but how would you characterize what's happening now? How big is this?
I mean, every administration has a tendency to want to champion the facts that support the policies and to bury the information that doesn't. But what we're seeing now is at a completely different scale. You know, across the board, science has been sidelined from decision-making at EPA with significant consequences for both public health and the environment.
Let's take a look. This is all according to the Union of Concerned Scientists. In 2019, 13 research centers that used to study how chemical exposure affects children defunded, it would seem, because at least one was publishing research on chlorpyrifos. This is the pesticide Dow Chemicals manufactures. The research center said it harms children's brains. In 2017, a new report on the cancer risks of formaldehyde, a common chemical, you know, it's in everything from plywood to glue. That report was suppressed because the EPA claims it's still checking the accuracy. There's been a rollback on asbestos protection or regulation. Last year, the EPA said that manufacturers can now get waivers if they want to use it. It's a known carcinogen. It's in things like wall insulation and bleach and bulletproof vests. And Andrew Wheeler, who's the head of the EPA, said this would strengthen public health. What did the EPA scientists say?
The scientists were unequivocal in saying that this is a dangerous product that needs to be phased out. It's been phased out all across the world, and it needs to happen here too. in this case, as in many cases, the scientists aren't even consulted when the rule is being put forward and when the decision is being made. And they find out about the decision the way the rest of us do, through the news or through an agency announcement. And so what we're seeing is the wholesale sidelining of agency experts from important processes that are supposed to protect public health.
Yeah, well, and, you know, we've expressed here before that it's very alarming to scientists that before Wheeler was appointed head of the EPA, he was a lawyer that lobbied for the coal industry against the Obama administration's environmental regulations. I mean, is there a sense that the fox is in the hen house?
Absolutely. The fox has built the hen house here. You know, there seems to be this idea that they can disregard laws like the Clean Air Act in pursuit of the policies that they want to put forward. But the amount of air pollution that's going to sicken you or kill you doesn't depend on who wins an election or who's filling a seat at the top of the EPA. That's why we need the scientists to be able to tell us what the threats are and respond appropriately.
Yeah. What impact is this having on scientists? Because the Union of Concerned Scientists, you did a survey back in 2018 to find out. What did you hear?
Yeah, so we do surveys periodically of scientists and have done so for about 15 years. And scientists at EPA are worse off than they've ever been. They report significant political interference in their work, the impact of workforce reductions making it hard to do their jobs, and a lot of self-censorship that's happening at all levels on issues like climate change, on issues like chemical safety and security. And that kind of climate in which communication is discouraged makes it a lot more difficult for experts to speak openly with the public about health hazards, whether they're longstanding like lead or emerging problems like various viruses.
But, you know, when you say this is a problem, we understand asbestos. It's hard to imagine we'd reintroduce that in a big way into the culture. But what are you talking about some of the impact being? I mean, are you talking about specific things like breathing?
Yeah. So, you know, the Clean Air Act has been enormously successful because it is grounded in science. And the EPA has to go back and set a new standard every 5 years for different types of pollutants, including one called particulate matter. That's an air pollutant that makes asthma worse. It leads to early death in tens of thousands of people every year. And this is the time when EPA has to go back and look at that. Now, the science is clear. The EPA scientists have said that the current standard does not sufficiently protect public health and needs to be strengthened. Now, the EPA can't win on the science, so they're doing their best to sabotage that scientific process through which those standards are set. So, yes, they did fire a panel of the nation's top particulate matter experts saying that their expertise was no longer needed. And these scientists cared so much that they decided to meet anyway on their own time in a public meeting using the same procedures they would have under official EPA rules, and that submitted their findings to the agency for consideration so that they could set the record straight on what they believe a sufficiently protective standard would be. This has an impact on millions of people, and the standard that is set will, you know, determine whether the air that many of us breathe is sufficiently safe.
Yeah, we know the government in some occasions has responded through spokespeople saying, you know, in different occasions, different things, that rollbacks or cutbacks were because there was fat, there was overlap, or overreach, you know, overreach on the part of the EPA. We talked about the fact that the EPA is now packed with former industry insiders who would see overreach. But what's fascinating, though, is many of these scientists who were cherry-picked by the Trump administration are also objecting to what the EPA is doing. For example, water. Last month, the Trump administration finalized a rule which will undo Obama-era protections for streams and wetlands. And a government advisory board of scientists, many of them Trump appointees, wrote that the proposed water rule neglects established science. I mean, you know, we have Trump's own appointees contradicting his policies. Your thoughts on that?
Well, one of the great things about science-based laws like the Clean Air Act or the Clean Water Act is that the EPA has to show its work. They have to be able to justify their decisions based on scientific information. That's one reason why you've seen a lot of criticism, even from scientists who have been appointed by President Trump, And you've seen the administration lose a lot of lawsuits in court because they can't back up what they are trying to put forward. Now, it's important to note that even if they lose in court, they're still delaying a public protection from moving forward by months or years. And any public protections that are delayed benefits the polluters at the expense of the public. You know, only doing nothing in the face of evidence that a pollutant is harmful means that more people are going to get sick and more people are going to die, but also that the manufacturers of an unsafe product or practice will have months or years of additional profits.
We mentioned Houston during Hurricane Harvey. There were chemical spills, fires. ExxonMobil, Chevron, Valero all had breaches. Residents were, you know, calling the hotline because of gas smells. Superfund sites leaking into rivers and streams. Again, this is according to the Union of Concerned Scientists. NASA was planning to fly one of its hypersensitive planes over Houston to detect whether the air was safe. But according to emails obtained by the LA Times, the EPA said no thanks, which puzzled the NASA scientists. I'm assuming it's because of things like this. The House has actually passed out of committee the Scientific Integrity Act. It makes it illegal to distort or suppress scientific research. Six Republicans joined the 19 Democrats who voted it out of committee. But you testified before that committee in favor, obviously. And, you know, I'm just wondering, you know, we know that there are people who do not believe in science making policy. They might have been in that room. Did you feel that?
Well, I think that Republicans and Democrats both believe in science. They both benefit greatly from the use of science in policymaking. And so I think there is a growing appetite and understanding that you don't want politicians to get in the way of scientists to be able to share their research with the public. I hear this coming from all kinds of different advocates and all kinds of different policymakers. And so science policy is sexy right now, and we're going to try to do our best to make sure that that enthusiasm doesn't wane.
Science policy is sexy, one would hope. Michael Halpern, Deputy Director of the Center for Science and Democracy at the Union of Concerned Scientists, thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
And we reached out to the EPA for comment. Spokesman Michael Abu disputed many of the Union of Concerned Scientists' claims and said the EPA will continue to use the best available science, regardless of the claims of a few federal employees. His full statement, plus all of our stories and your comments at hereandnow.org.
The coronavirus is now to blame for nearly 500 deaths in China, and health experts say that number is expected to rise. And as quickly as this virus is spreading globally, so is anti-China sentiment, or xenophobia. Just this week, there was a report of an attack of a woman wearing a face mask in New York City, and the Chinese embassy in Denmark has demanded an apology after a newspaper there published an image depicting the Chinese flag with a virus-like figure in place of yellow stars. To talk more about this, we're joined by Dr. Seema Yasmin, a journalist and clinical assistant professor at Stanford University. Welcome.
Thank you, Tanya.
This anti-Chinese sentiment, you've studied this kind of thing. This is not the first time we've seen societies racializing a disease, so to speak. Is that right?
That's absolutely right. We saw it during the SARS epidemic of 2002 to 2003, when the virus arrived in Toronto and people started referring to SARS as the Chinese disease. And that had very real implications for Asian people. Because of that belief, Chinese-owned businesses in Toronto saw an 80% reduction in revenue that year, and some even went out of business. And this idea of the yellow peril, as it's been known, dates back even further, and it's linked to this idea that migrants and foreign people carry disease. It's been really used to push anti-immigrant rhetoric as well. There is one example of this I think it's important to point out, which is when European colonizers came to America with diseases and weaponized infections to kill indigenous people. But otherwise, this long-standing trope of infectious migrants has been studied and it's been debunked.
You mentioned what Chinese store owners went through in Toronto. That is a financial impact. I can only imagine that there's a deep psychological toll as well on being deemed suspicious. Can you talk more about that?
the American Academy of Pediatrics released a statement actually in July of last year that said racism has a profound impact on the health of children. That's true of adults too, and that racism is by design an entirely alienating experience. It causes anxiety, depression, and anger. We're hearing of Asian doctors here in the US being rejected by patients. So these impacts, they run deep and they affect people's everyday lives.
In many ways, a lot of this xenophobia and normalization of this fear is rooted, though, in a desire people have to be safe and not get sick. How can we combat the spread of both the coronavirus and this fear of certain bodies at the same time?
I think, though, that it's actually rooted in racism and the need to continue justifying the othering of people who are not white. And I think that's why we see this very overt racism with many epidemics, whether it's SARS, Ebola, or a new coronavirus. Epidemics shed light, I think, on existing injustices every time, and they shed a light on the inadequacies of governments. So the disease might be new, but the racism that it exacerbates is not new. And what we have to do is really, really emphasize that it's not who you are, it's what you do and where you are that puts you at risk of disease. There's a real danger to fearing other people's bodies, both for those people who are othered, but also because having this nonsense belief that only certain people will get the disease actually means you're really misinformed and puts you at risk of infection. It also means you're ignoring the very real risks to your health, which, if you're American, the real risk to your health right now is flu.
That's Dr. Seema Yasmin of Stanford University. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
More than a dozen families in Flint, Michigan, are suing the school system there, arguing their children were exposed to brain-damaging levels of lead during the water crisis there 6 years ago. The parents believe that exposure may have caused or exacerbated their children's special needs. These families will make their case in court this summer. This case is just one of several lawsuits against the Flint school system. The city's rate of special education students has grown steadily since the water crisis began. 28% of students there are in special education. The national average is about 13%. For more, we're joined by Flint resident and mother Jessica Gutierrez and education attorney Kristen Totten with the ACLU of Michigan. Welcome to you both.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, thank you.
And Jessica, I want to start with you. You're a mother of five, born and raised in Flint. Tell us more about your children and where they attend school.
Presently, they're spread out in different schools. So I have one daughter that goes to a charter school and she's in the seventh. And then I have two that are going to a school inside the city of Flint, which is like a private school. And then I have a little one that's in early on. And then I have one that is attending a dual enrolled school that's a part of U of M.
Mm-hmm. Medical professionals have said there's no way to prove conclusively that lead has caused new disabilities in Flint. But we know that children exposed to lead are at higher risk of neurological damage and developmental delays. Jessica, no one knows their children better than a mother, and you've certainly seen changes in your children. What can you tell us that you've seen?
Well, I've seen issues where I have had a child that was potty trained, and now all of a sudden she has a problem with incontinence, and it's been going on for about three and a half years. The worst types of behavioral issues are the ones where you can see that your child realizes that what they're doing is not normal. And the worst thing about that is that if you didn't have a background about why your children are behaving the way that they are, you would think that they're just inherently being disobedient. So if I jump a little bit forward, the state of Michigan put into play basically a system or a place, a medical place where you can get your children tested for neurological testing.
Mm-hmm.
So when you go and you get your child tested, and you find out that there is something most definitely wrong with your child, it's like a re-traumatization all over again because, oh my goodness, all of these times I harshly punished my kid. So you have that to go back over.
And that's what you found in your case specifically with your family. Your children were tested
and they were formally diagnosed.
Yes, with different conditions. And the thing is, you leave and you're like, so what do I do now? And that's not the only question that parents have. Some of the teachers that I've spoken with are also having that concern. I was pregnant during 2014. I had my baby in 2015. And there are programs early on for the little ones. And so what now they're starting to see is now this is the influx, the introduction of the children that were just at like the precipice of the water crisis. They were in utero. Their parents were drinking the water. They were drinking, feeding it with their kids in the bottles. And what they're seeing with the students is they don't know how to handle it.
I want to bring in Kristen Totten, and we're going to talk a little bit about the resources within Flint schools and the city at large, because it was already a city strapped for cash in a very significant way. But Kristen, in the past few years, 15 city and state officials have been indicted for their actions related to this crisis. I mean, it goes without saying that this fight is far from over. Part of the reason, though, that we're seeing a spike in the number of children in special education is because of the requirement that the school system test the children for special needs. Is that correct? Can you tell us more about that?
Sure. So we brought this lawsuit back in October of 2016 after approaching the state to say, you're doing things for the 0 to 5 population, but what are you doing for the K through 12 population? And what they were able to tell us is that they were providing nutritional supplements, some leafy green vegetables, and nurses, which is a good thing, but we knew that was going to fall very short as to what the need would demand, because we had been watching Flint even before the water crisis and knowing that they were not meeting their obligations under the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, which one requires that you find the children who are struggling to learn and then you provide them with a free, appropriate public education. We knew that they weren't doing this because we were also monitoring the level of suspensions and expulsions from the Flint Community School District, and we found that it was the highest in the state. Mm. So we had to file this lawsuit in October of 2016, along with the New York law firm of White & Case and also the Education Law Center of New Jersey. We filed it, and by October 2017, we were realizing, like, not enough is happening. And so we filed a preliminary injunction, and we knew that utilizing the psychoeducational evaluations that are typical in schools when you assess to see if a child has a disability were too subjective. So we filed this preliminary injunction. We had excellent neuropsychologists come out and perform neuropsychs on 8 of our named plaintiffs, and they found devastating impacts. In our case, we don't have to say that it's because of the lead. It could be because of the trauma that's related to the lead. Mm. But we know that a neuropsychological evaluation is what really gets into targeting what cognitive functions have been impacted.
That's important what you said there, that not only perhaps the direct causation of what we're seeing, the neurological changes in the children, but there are all of these other factors that are related to the lead being in the water, as you said, the emotional impacts as well.
Yes, there was some assessments done of adults in Flint and a finding of PTSD. We needed to make sure that we filed this lawsuit to tell the families of Flint, we see you, we validate what you're seeing in your children, and we're going to make sure that the school district, but more importantly, the Genesee Intermediate School District and the state of Michigan through the Michigan Department of Education sends what resources are needed for what the state inflicted upon these families.
I want to ask you more about that because, as I mentioned earlier, Flint schools were strapped for cash. The city in general has seen a major decline over the last few decades. And since this water crisis, the school district has had to lay off staff and divert funds from general education programs to this growing special needs population. Flint actually says that it's argued that they're doing the best that they can. They've said that in the past. But this begs a larger question that you sort of touched on. Is this a bigger issue that perhaps federal intervention is needed here?
It is a much bigger issue than what the Flint Community Schools and the superintendent, Tawab, at the time, he went before a congressional hearing panel and told them that we would need additional supports for special education. It hasn't come through the state, it hasn't come through the county, and it hasn't come through the feds. And what we're enforcing in this lawsuit in federal court is a federal entitlement statute that children are identified and that their disability-related needs are provided with accommodations and services so that they can access a quality education.
Mm-hmm. Jessica, all five of your children received the screening and evaluation for special education, as you mentioned. Are they in special programs within the schools that they're in? I know that they're at various places throughout Flint.
The only special program that any of my children are in is the four-year-old. And I'm kind of disgusted because I'm feeling like, is there some sort of plan to create monsters that you can later hunt? And if you know that lead affects them in this way, you're putting them out because, okay, there's nothing else you could do with them. You have a class that you need to teach. So then you have parents pulling their kids out of school and trying to do online home tutoring.
Yeah, there's been actually a spike in homeschooling in Flint. But one thing I just want to get from you, Jessica, in particular, you were born and raised in Flint. This is your home. I assume this is part of the reason why you're staying there despite all of this. What is your call to action? It's now going to the courts, but really you want to continue to keep Flint as your home and have your children thrive there.
Yes. My call to action is if you have the privilege and you have the knowledge about the workings of the school system and you run into a parent or you see a parent or a child that needs help, advocate for them. And we hope that the cure to fix this problem will come in our time. It's mm-hmm. not just to help the future, because we need help now.
That's Jessica Gutierrez, an education attorney, Kristen Totten with the ACLU of Michigan. Thank you both for taking the time to shed light on this very important issue.
Thank you for having us.
You want 20/20 vision, cholesterol under 200, blood pressure around 120 over 80, and temperature? Well, that little marker on the old mercury thermometer says it all, 98.6. Except that nearly 170 years after that was determined to be the norm, scientists say it's lower. Now, we know our bodies are little engines with cells turning food into energy, creating heat and temperature, but what does it mean that it's lower? The new study from researchers at Stanford's medical school is called Decreasing Human Body Temperature in the United States Since the Industrial Revolution. Researcher Catherine Lay joins us now. And Dr. Lay, what's the new finding?
98.6 is too high. And we think that the average normal human body temperature is closer to 97.5.
But let's back up. How did we determine that the temperature for a well-functioning engine should be 98.6?
That was determined in 1851. A German physician called Karl Wunderlich measured millions of temperature measurements from 25,000 patients. And that's how he came up with 98.6. So that population in an era where people were really quite different. There was a lot of infection in the population, like tuberculosis and syphilis and periodontitis, lots of chronic inflammation that may well have, we think, influenced the normal body temperature of that era.
Meaning what? People were having to fight off more infections? They might have just run a little hotter?
Yes, well, we know that since then our standard of living has increased dramatically. Economic development, changes in hygiene. We've taken all sorts of infections away.
Yeah. Well, and we've also made it easier for us to fight them. We have heating. We have air conditioning. The body doesn't have to do as much.
That's absolutely right. We know that we spend a lot of time trying to keep our core temperature the same in extremes of heat and cold. And in the 1850s, houses were rarely heated. By the 1920s, we had lots of heating, and then we've had cooling coming through more recently. So the amount of time that our bodies have to spend outside of a pretty narrow band where we don't have to use energy to stay at the right temperature has increased a lot.
Well, in continuing with your research, what data did you look at to come to the conclusion that it's our average temperature is lower?
We had readings from the pension records of Civil War veterans starting in at the 1860s all the way through 1940. We looked at a data set collected by the CDC in the early 70s. And then we had data here from Stanford from the 2007 to 2017. And overall, we found that the temperatures of the Civil War veterans were higher than the measurements taken from the 1970s. And in turn, those measurements were higher than those collected in the 2000s. And two things were really striking. One, the amount of change across that time period, and the fact that the temperature has continued to decline at the same rate across that time period.
Talk about the role of anti-inflammatories in maybe reducing our temperatures.
So their goal is to reduce inflammation. So we have aspirin and statins and non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. And so decreasing inflammation is associated with reducing temperature.
Yeah, and these are drugs like ibuprofen, a generic form of Advil and Motrin. Does this mean that overall, because our temperatures are a little bit lower, we are healthier?
We believe that that's the case. We don't know that body temperature really matters as a measure of wellness on an individual level. We don't even know what average temperature means for a population. We do know, for example, that temperature on average is higher in women than in men, that older people are cooler than younger people, that temperature increases with your weight, and that there's a huge variation across the day.
Right. It's interesting because I've always had a lower temperature, so I've always known that if I am up at 98.6, I might have a slight fever. So that's true, right? I mean, everybody has to know what their baseline is.
That's exactly right. If you're an elderly person making a morning visit to a doctor's office complaining of illness with a temperature of 98.6, then we really have to think what that means. It's not normal for an elderly person to have that temperature so early in the day.
Right.
And so we really should start thinking about normal temperature on a more individual level based on age and sex, time of day, height, weight.
Yeah. Well, and because we read that early in the morning, we haven't warmed up yet. So all of our temperatures are a little bit lower. It's really fascinating. Kids are going to have a field day with this. Mom's going to say, you don't have a fever. You're going to school. No, really, I do because I have lower temperature.
I think that's some of the work that needs to be done, right? Actually generating the values for normal temperatures for our individual age and sex, height, weight, time of day.
Yep. That's Stanford researcher Catherine Lay, one of the authors of a new study showing that average human temperature, the norm as it was called, is no longer 98.6. It's been falling since the Industrial Revolution, and right now it is, drumroll, 97.5. Catherine, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
And Tanya, I had my temperature taken recently with one of those fancy doctor's things, and it was 96 degrees. I'm so glad to hear, you know, like, I'm not dead.
That's right. Just know your baseline. That's the important takeaway.
This is going to work into all the arguments over the thermostat in offices. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.